The Cycling Podcast, in association with RAFA. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, RAFA exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Hello, welcome to the Cycling Podcast. I'm Richard Moore, I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello, chaps. How's it going?
Daniel, in a field, perhaps, Daniel?
A citrus grove.
A meadow?
A citrus grove.
Yeah, I should have guessed.
Lemons to the left of me, oranges to the right. I'm stuck here in the middle with you. Yeah. I'm not sure that worked entirely.
Nice improv.
Anyway.
When life gives you lemons, Daniel.
There's a cockerel, I think, as well in the vicinity. We might hear from the cockerel. Is it Mark Maddio with the cockerel, controlling the cockerel?
I think there are multiple cockerels. I thought it was a turkey at first. I'm more au fait with things like kiwi fruit production than I am with ornithology. Anyway.
I'm not sure turkeys and cockerels count as ornithology.
Do they not?
Really? Not really. Poultry, aren't they?
Oh, okay. You're the expert, of course, on poultry.
Not many twitchers go out looking for a turkey.
Yeah, Lionel. When Lionel sees a turkey, he's not thinking binoculars. He's thinking...
Lunch.
Frankly. And we've got lots to cram in this week, as ever. Mainly a Mark Cavendish interview. Daniel, you went to see Mark Cavendish. He is in Mallorca, I believe. You're in Mallorca as well. And he's come to the island.
I think he came to see me, more like. Anyway.
Well, obviously. He's arrived on the island, I guess, this is an interlude between Argentina and UAE. Is that correct?
Correct.
Doing a bit of track work? In the
track
Velodrome
work,
at Palma?
Generally speaking, I think he's outdoors in the morning, indoors in the evening.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with RAFA.
Thank you very much to our headline sponsor, RAFA. Grateful to them, of course, for their support. They are still teasing some of their new items for 2019. But one thing that caught my eye this week was a reissued jersey commemorating Marco Pantani. This week, of course, is 15 years since Pantani died on February the 14th, 2004. And to mark that occasion, RAFA have reissued the Pantani jersey, which is a lovely pink design, as modelled on the RAFA website by Tom Southam, the former professional rider, now a director sportif with Education First. And in fact, there's an essay on rafa.cc by Tom Southam about Marco Pantani. It's called The Saint and the Sinner. And as well as everything else, as well as being a model, a former rider, and now a DS, Tom Southam is a very good writer as well. It's well worth a read. A really thought-provoking piece about Marco Pantani. You'll find that and the Pantani jersey at rafa.cc. Lionel, have you got a news roundup? I suspect this, you'll be interrupted quite a lot in this news roundup.
Yeah, I think so. This first section, we'll go for a sort of free-form jazz approach to the news roundup. You know, you guys chip in as and when there's a story you want
much.
To contribute.
Well, if I've got something to say, I'll just put my hand up. Give me the nod.
Okay. Well, let's start with the racing then, shall we? The big race of the week was the Volta. Richard?
I was just testing your reactions.
I see. It was the Volta a la Comunitat Valenciana. Won by Astana's Jon Izagirre overall. His teammate Pello Bilbao was third, and Alejandro Valverde, the world champion, was sandwiched. He was in the Astana, the ice cream in the Astana sandwich. No, the jam in the Astana sandwich, sorry, in second place. Astana had a very good week, really. Took the race on the big day to Alcosebra. Now, Daniel, I was asking Richard about this. Was that the same climb that Alexei Lutsenko won on in the 2017 Vuelta?
It was, Lionel.
It looked very familiar, and then I looked it up and thought, I'm sure I've been there. Well, that was the day that Adam Yates won for Mitchelton Scott.
Was Marco Haller not with Lutsenko as they approached that climb? Your friend Marco Haller, Daniel.
You're testing me now. I can remember.
I think he was.
Marawi Kudus being in the
shape. Oh, sorry. I'm maybe thinking of another day.
Yeah.
As you were.
Interesting you mentioned Kudus, because Kudus was again very active this week. sort of playing the setup role for Astana on the climb. But as I say, Adam Yates won the big stage. Izaguirre won overall. There were also wins for Edvald Boasenhagen, who won the opening time trial. Matteo Trentin, Greg Van Avermaet, and Dylan Groenewegen won the other stages. There was also a women's...
Did they perform a rap on the podium by way of celebration, Astana? Was there a winner's rap?
I think that's been consigned to distant history,
buried
in the you know, under a Kazakh mountain, hopefully. all trace of it destroyed. There was also a women's race held on the same course as the final stage in Valencia, and that was won by Lotta Kopecky of Lotto Soudal. In France, in the south of France, Christophe Laporte of Cofidis won a couple of stages of the Étoile de Bessège, which gave him the overall victory. This week's race is the Tour Colombia 2.1. It's been rebranded, renamed. I've seen the opening stage, which was the team time trial, won by EF Education First, which has put Rigoberto Urán into the lead. They beat De Koenig Quickstep and Team Sky in the team time trial. That race goes on until the weekend. But the remarkable thing about it is the size of the crowds. I mean, it looks absolutely incredible. They had the team presentation in a stadium. Big crowd turned up to that. Real sense of momentum behind cycling in Colombia at the moment. And that kind of dovetails neatly with some rumours and reports that Dave Brailsford has met with the president of Colombia, Ivan Duque, about Colombia possibly being the replacement sponsor for Team Sky. We will have to watch that. But it is notable that Sky are out there racing with Ivan Sosa and Egan Bernal, two very exciting young Colombian riders, and Chris Froome.
Did we not mention this possibility, though, a few weeks ago on the podcast, that Brailsford may well look to Colombia for funding?
We did. We leapt in with some wild speculation based on kind of what would make
a conversation
sense
with Dave Brailsford that where he said that might be an avenue for them to explore. So,
well, it makes sense,
yeah,
doesn't it?
I know. They've had a lot of Colombian riders, and of course, I think we've mentioned before in the podcast that Dave Brailsford and Team Sky have a very good relationship with an agent, an Italian agent, Giuseppe Acquadoro, who has most of the top Colombian riders on his books. There was a time, I haven't done a count recently, but there was a time a couple of years ago when about half of the Team Sky roster was made up of riders from that particular agent stable.
And Rigoberto Urán seems to be a linchpin here as well. He's a former Team Sky rider, of course. He is like a kind of Vinokourov figure in Colombia. He's the real...
Careful.
Well, I mean, in terms of his status, I think I've said this already, but we shared a hotel with the Colombian team at the World Championships in Innsbruck last year, and speaking to the Colombian staff, they were all talking about just how much of a talisman Urán was. And when he arrived, you know, he had rules: no phones at the table, we leave for training at this time. All the riders, including the likes of Quintana and Lopez, looked up to Urán as the leader. And it seems that he is the guy who has, beyond his performances on the bike, has the real influence, I think, both among the riders and maybe further afield. So, I mean, Urán could be quite involved in something like that, because I think this is the final year of his contract with EF Education First as well. So who knows?
Yeah, I mean, certainly it would appear there would be more chance of Brailsford joining up with Colombia in some sense rather than with Oleg Tinkoff, which was the other big rumour this week, strongly denied by Tinkoff himself, who used Francois Tomazo's favourite word to rebuff those reports. Sticking with Sky, sort of, I guess, former Sky British cycling doctor...
In the name of our free-flowing jazz approach, Lionel, just quickly before we move on from the sponsorship and Team Sky, any rumours at your end, chaps, about whether Dave Brailsford has or hasn't got other offers beyond this possibility of a Colombian interest?
This sounds like a loaded question,
Daniel. Well, I've heard from a couple of people...
Joining the jam with a trombone.
Setting yourself up here, eh? For the easy finish, the tapping.
I understand that there might be a couple of offers, if not on the table there, then inching their way towards the table.
Interesting.
Interesting.
Well,
nothing from your end?
Nothing. The last I heard was a proposal was being put together to go to market to try and find a new sponsor, but this hadn't been done yet. a few weeks ago. This hadn't been completed yet. So the search hadn't, it seemed to me, the search hadn't really begun in earnest as recently as 3 weeks ago. And I don't know what's happened since then. But yeah, I mean, there are rumours that there are possible replacements, you know, but a meeting with the Colombian president suggests that it's all still for up for grabs and nothing is, certainly nothing decided.
Well, one thing that wouldn't help a search response would be for the team to be mired in some kind of doping controversy. And, well, the former Sky and British Cycling doctor, Richard Freeman, was supposed to be at a hearing of the General Medical Council in Manchester last week. The GMC is investigating, among other things, the delivery of testosterone to British Cycling's headquarters in Manchester in, I think, May 2011, just before the Dauphiné Libre in 2011, just before the TUE applications for Bradley Wiggins went in. There has been a suggestion that this hearing may now be adjourned until late this year or possibly even next year. Damien Collins MP, the chairman of the Digital Culture, Media and Sport Parliamentary Select Committee, has called this a delaying tactic on the part of Freeman and his lawyer. You may remember that Freeman did not appear before the DCMS committee in December 2016, saying he was suffering from severe depression. He has submitted written evidence to that, but was not questioned in person. What the awkward thing about this is that Freeman was available to do press and publicity for his book last year. And it is very difficult to avoid the conclusion that this is there's an element of selection about when and when he is and when he isn't available to answer questions.
But do we know for sure that he isn't declared himself, or he has been declared unavailable for these hearing?
We don't know. He was also supposed to appear recently at the Jess Varnish hearing, her case against British Cycling. He was due to appear as a witness for Jess Varnish and didn't. I think the assumption on this occasion is that he is not well enough to attend, but we don't know that for sure. I've been trying to find out this week, and you know, some of his former colleagues have not been in touch with him recently. He seems to have gone to ground a little bit, and nobody seems too sure as to his state of health at the moment.
Daniel, what do you mean there? I mean, he didn't turn up, so clearly he's not been there. Are you saying that, you know, there's been some kind of legal argument?
Yeah, that was kind of what I was getting at.
But I mean, I know this is what happens with legal things. This seems to be quite a simple case to me.
Simple in what?
The question is simple.
How did
the testosterone patches come to be delivered? Go answer the questions. Tell the truth, obviously, as you would be obliged to do a general medical council hearing. Clear it up once and for all.
It's simple, presuming there's an innocent, from his point of view, presuming there's an innocent explanation, which we don't know whether that's the case or not. I mean, we've spoken before, haven't we, about how alarming the allegation is. Testosterone is a substance that has been abused, is abused in all kinds of sport, not just endurance sport. It's a substance that is quite difficult to detect. You know, there's lots of literature which suggests you can microdose or even not microdose, take relatively normal doses of testosterone, get a benefit for your performance and not test positive. And the quantity involved in this case, it's not a lot. It's certainly not enough to dope a whole organization. It might be enough to dope one athlete for a month or so, or be used legitimately in hormone replacement therapy for, I understand, about a month. I mean, it was 30 sachets of 50 milligrams, which is usually 30 times a daily dose, I think, in hormone replacement therapy.
And Freeman has said that his defence will be that it was for a member of staff rather than for an athlete, of course. And, you know, it's used in anti-aging. I remember the former Sunday Times writer A.A. Gill going to see a Harley Street specialist and being prescribed testosterone for anti-aging. So men in their 50s, 60s. We're rapidly approaching that ourselves, Lionel. Maybe we'll be on the old testosterone patches in a decade or so. I don't know. But it is. It's commonly used for older men now. And that, as we understand it, will be Richard Freeman's explanation. As you say, Lionel, that sounds pretty straightforward. What is so puzzling about this, though, and I've mentioned this before, but if you're going to use testosterone to cheat, why would you order it from your regular supplier, creating a paper trail? Why would you have it delivered to the velodrome? These things don't make any sense at all. And why is a company like Fit for Sport, which was a company that supplied lots of sports teams, why are they stocking and supplying testosterone products?
Well, these are very good questions. And I think that the most troubling thing about this entire situation is, just to go back to the beginning, really, is that Dr. Freeman is picking and choosing when he's available to answer and what he's available to answer. I remember in the round of publicity for his book, I mean, we didn't actually interview him. We were offered the opportunity to talk to him.
It was set up.
It became pretty clear that any of the questions
he pulled out.
Any of the questions we wanted to ask, he wouldn't have been able to answer. And even in his interview with Dan Rowan of the BBC, you know, there is a sense that the defence was, well, I can't answer that because that is the subject of the General Medical Council's investigation, or UK Sports investigation, using the investigations as a shield to not place on the record any comments or answers to any questions. And then when it comes to the hearings themselves, not turning up and answering those questions. It seems to me, to say the least, unsatisfactory. And, I don't think there's going to be much appetite from people to let this drop, especially if it drags on.
The other issue, Lionel, I mean, there's been debate and mention made of the statute of limitations, but another issue is, should it be established that Richard Freeman had acquired this testosterone for nefarious purposes, that he was going to dope athletes, or he intended to dope athletes, then that fact itself, who he was going to dope, and whether that was his real intention, is also quite a difficult thing to prove. If after this set of hearings we get a case being opened, or this specific allegation being pursued by UK Anti-Doping. You know, as we all know, after Operation Puerto in 2006, and Ivan Basso, for example, his excuse that he'd only attempted to dope, that is sanctionable under the WADA code. However, you know, that was the athlete himself admitting that he had attempted to dope. And when it's a doctor, it might become a little bit murkier.
Well, it's certainly opaque at the moment, and no sign of any clarity in the short term, at least. Finally, for this Freeform Jazz News Roundup, do the bagpipes play a part in jazz?
Oh, I think the Freeform suggests that anything goes.
Well, that's the sound of bagpipes. And the news that the Bumper World Cycling Championships in 2023 will be held in Scotland, mainly centred on Glasgow. 13 cycling disciplines, all taking place in one place in August. So that's the road championships, track championships, mountain biking, BMX, paracycling, indoor cycling.
Gran Fondo
World Championships as well. And normally, these championships are all held in different places at different times of the year. But for every 4 years, the year before the Olympic Games year, so 2023 is the first time, these championships will all be held together. A really, really dramatic and exciting development for cycling.
I think all credit to David Lapartion, who you know, has come up with this idea. I think it's his idea, and he's acted pretty quickly to make it happen. It's a really enticing prospect. Quite interesting, because these different championships all sort of attract different audiences as well. You know, you're not going to go to the road championships and the BMX championships. So be a real kind of festival of cycling. And contrary to some reports, because I did seek clarification on this from Paul Bush, who is chief executive of Events Scotland, who've been, it goes all the way back actually with Paul Bush to 2007 and the Grand Départ of the Tour de France in London. He was inspired by that to try and bring the Tour de France to Scotland, to Edinburgh. He met with ASO that year. Then Gary Verity kind of wriggled his way in between Paul Busch and Christian Prudhomme, and brought the Tour de France obviously to Yorkshire in 2014. And the bid to bring the Tour de France to Scotland went dormant, really. But this is, I think, a bigger deal. I think it's going to be terrific. It's not, as it was reported by some people, a Glasgow bid. The track cycling will certainly happen at the Chris Hoy Velodrome in Glasgow. But the road cycling and the mountain biking, I would think, would happen in Fort William, where they regularly have the World Cup, but it could happen in Glentress, just south of Edinburgh. I think from my conversations, the road race is likely to use the Glasgow finishing circuit, but it will start potentially in Edinburgh and go in all throughout the central belt, maybe to Stirling. There was a lot of talk of the castles, so maybe Edinburgh Castle, Stirling Castle, other landmarks around that area, and then a finishing circuit in Glasgow, which we saw used for the Commonwealth Games road race in 2014, won by Geraint Thomas, and the European Championship last year, won by Matteo Trentin. I'm not totally enthusiastic about that. I think it's not a very challenging circuit, and it's a shame that I don't think we're going to see a very, you know, hilly World Championship that year. Now, that's fine, but Scotland has a lot to offer in terms of really spectacular roads and backdrops, and I'm not sure we're going to, unfortunately, that would involve taking the race outside of a main population centre, and I don't think that's going to happen, which I think is a shame.
A shame for the race, maybe, but not a shame for people who want a week-long festival of cycling. Well, it's longer than a week, isn't it?
I think it's a bit of a shame when you think of Scotland's national identity. You know, you think of William Wallace and Rob Roy and all those great characters we discussed a few weeks ago. No, but seriously, on a serious note, one of Scotland's great selling points as a tourist destination is its mountains. And it's one of the first images that comes into people's minds when they think of Scotland is, you know, that landscape. And to not display that and make a show of that, I think, would be a bit of a shame.
How big a place is Bergen, for example, where, you know, which provided a spectacular setting for the Worlds a couple of years ago, and there are towns of, I think, on that sort of scale further north. Why not have it based around Inverness or Aviemore or somewhere that, you know, close to mountains, where I think you could get a really spectacular race,
especially when the people bringing it is Event Scotland, I guess.
Yeah, but there'll be a lot of pressure. A lot of the money, I guess, will come from Glasgow, and there'll be a lot of pressure for it to be in Glasgow, which
would it be possible, with your knowledge of the area, Rich, to start in Edinburgh and have a really challenging, not a circuit, but a loop out into the countryside, and then come in and just have a finishing circuit?
Yeah, they'll do that. They'll do that. But the central belt in Scotland, it's not very close to any significant climbs or mountains. Right. So, yeah, shame.
Well, let's not, you know... It hasn't been decided yet.
Let's see
what they come up with.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast, team car, at the back of the pack, please.
We've been interrupted there by Seb Piquet, the voice of Race Radio at the Tour de France, of course. And that's to remind me to tell you that this week's episode is sponsored by Laka, returning Laka. Lionel, what can you tell us about Laka?
Well, Rich, Laka is a smarter way of insuring your bikes and gear. It's a community of cyclists joining together to play fair and take good care in order to save each other money. Laka covers all the basics you'd expect: theft, accidental loss and damage, both at home and abroad. And it also covers you in sportives and races, as long as you're not riding in the pro peloton. They're not going to start insuring the World Tour teams. Instead of charging you a fixed premium, you only pay a small share of the community's claim costs, and your share is proportionate to how much you insure yourself with Laka. So while your share can theoretically go down to £0 if there are no claims in a particular month, Laka also locks in a maximum price to ensure that there are no nasty surprises, even in months when there are lots of claims. Claims are accepted quickly, usually within a day. But don't take our word for it. Let's hear from one of Laka's customers who had to make a claim while riding his bike on holiday.
I've travelled a lot over the last year internationally with my bike. I took it to my wife's chagrin on every holiday I went on and spent a lot of time cycling. I'm Philip Meyer. I've been a Laka customer since April 2018. I tried to ride about 150 to 200 kilometres a week. I went out on actually what turned out to be the longest cycle I've ever done. Well, it was the longest at the time. About halfway through the 150k ride, the third-party mount that I had for my cycling computer broke for no apparent reason. My cycling computer flew into the air, catapulted along and landed on the floor and just smashed into pieces. So I was pretty distraught, mainly actually about the fact that it wasn't going to record my ride rather than the fact that that it was broken. But it was a pretty expensive piece of kit, so I followed up with Lacca that afternoon. I used their app, then actually followed up with them on the phone because I wasn't quite sure what to do. I had a brilliant experience. I can't say how positive and helpful they were. And I told them that, you know, I was away cycling. I needed this. There's no way I could survive without a cycling computer. And so I went to the shop the next day and just bought a replacement. It was expensive, 590 quid, I think it cost. Sent them the receipt. I mean, I was really surprised because the money was back in my account by the time I went to bed that evening. And actually, I'd sent them the receipt. I'd also bought a pair of socks I couldn't resist. And they paid me back for the socks as well as a way of sort of sympathizing with me, I guess. Anyway, so it was a really positive experience. They were so friendly, so helpful. And I was just stunned, having had other insurance claims in the past, which took forever and where you almost made feel like a criminal. These guys were just positive, friendly, and went out of their way to help me, you know. And it was an expensive piece of kit, so it would have been a pain on holiday to have been short of that money.
Lacca's members have saved 61% on their bike insurance, and that's money that could be spent on a new piece of kit or put towards a training camp or a cycling holiday. So if you want to find out more about Lacca, go to lacca.co.uk. that's lacca.co.uk.
so if you would like to sign up for Lacca, you can use the discount code PODCAST for a £10 credit if you are a new customer. That's discount code PODCAST, and you enter that code when you register your bikes on the payment screen.
Now, I mentioned at the start that we've got an interview with Mark Cavendish in this episode. We're going to hear it now. Daniel, you met up with Mark the other day.
I met up with Mark yesterday in Palma in Mallorca over a piece of cheesecake, and he told me exactly why he'd come to Mallorca and what he was going to do here.
I literally decided to come, I don't know, a week ago. It was like, I want to go somewhere where I could do mountains and a bit of velodrome in the same day, really, you know. And Juan Linares, like Olympic world's points Madison champion, like he's the best points race rider ever, I think. Yeah. He runs a velodrome here, so it was a case of getting in contact with him, seeing if I could get time, and yeah, it was no problem at all. So I was like, okay, go for a week, get some mountain climbing in me, and get some speed work on the velodrome, really.
So people will remember that your very successful season in 2016, you spent a lot of time on the track that year. Are people right to make the connection that you're doing track work to benefit your road work, or are you looking to objectives, you know, maybe beyond 2019?
I don't know. People like put connections with everything. Like, apparently I lost it. You know what I mean? So I don't know. I don't know. People think what they want. I'll just do what I think works for me. Kind of miss it when I get on. It kind of feels a bit natural as well, you know. But yeah, more than anything, it's more for the training than qualifying for anything just yet, I think. So.
But it's always benefited your road racing, hasn't it? Time on the track.
Oh, absolutely does. Like, you use fixed gears, use the kind of muscles that kind of get a bit lazy when I'm on the road, I guess. You know, don't have a massive power output. Don't have a lot of torque, so.
You got a lot of torque. You've definitely got a lot of torque.
Ah, I see what you did there. You should write a book with puns like that. Like, how's your book coming along, by the way?
Let's not talk about that. Tell us about the start of the season. You're back racing. You were in Argentina last week or 10 days ago. How did that go? What was it like being back in the action?
The first few days was horrible. Like, okay, it was hot, and we only arrived there a couple of days before. Like, it was ridiculously hot. So I don't know whether it was a shock to get back into racing, whether it was a shock of the heat, but the first few days I was absolutely way over my limit. But after 3 days, I really settled in. It was nice, you know. I could see then that I was fit, you know. I've done so much work over the winter, and I felt like to ease back into it. But did definitely miss a zip that comes from racing. Like, it's not just having 7 months away from racing. Like, basically I've had 2 years without doing much. You know, I haven't been able to race. I've been in races, but I haven't really been racing. I've just been kind of hanging there suffering. And so yeah, I have all that time to catch up, like nearly 2 years now, I guess. Year and a half anyway, that's for sure.
And I think there's been a bit of confusion about what you have been suffering from the last couple of years. One thing that most people think they understand is that it will affect your recovery, or it has affected your recovery. So how was that in Argentina?
Yeah, all right, but we had a rest day, so it was kind of hard to tell. I just have to see. Like, yeah, I think nobody quite understands what it is. Like, okay, it's been reported a lot. Like, I've had two bouts of Monaco. The evidence suggests, like, I haven't... It's not two bouts. Like, it's the same bout. I never got over it the first time, you know? That's hard to try and explain to people. Makes me look like I'm not very resilient, you know, whereas it was completely mismanaged and perhaps has damaged, like, my career for sure, and perhaps my legacy, you know, which makes me angry, you know, but all I can do is try my best to get that back, you know. Like, it's, nobody who hasn't had this can understand what it is. Like, Mark Renshaw had Epstein-Barr a few years ago, and honestly, I thought, it's just him, he's a bit soft, you know, so I just thought he was just being soft. And then actually when I first got it, I had to call him and I said, mate, although I didn't say anything to you, like, I owe you a massive apology, mate, because I honestly, like, it's the worst thing. I'd rather smash every bone in my body than have this, you know. And I've been pissing in the wind trying to race on it for a year and a half, you know, now. That's the thing, like, you said that, oh, you finished. Like, how the f*** can you be finished after you're second in the world road, like, and I think that was technically, I was bad, not physically. I won the worlds on the track, yellow jersey in the tour, four stages. You don't just lose that. You don't just finish after that. Like, what the f*** is wrong with people? Like, seriously, what is wrong with people? And it's your colleagues, your journalist colleagues, that are the worst for it. Like, listen, if you don't know about cycling, don't try and pretend to know about cycling. Report on the facts rather than report on your kind of theories on you know.
The virus itself and, you know, your recovery process from it. How are you monitoring that now on a sort of day-to-day basis? How do the team monitor it? How do your medical staff monitor it?
Yeah, I've got blood tests every month. It is now. It was every couple of weeks previous. But, yeah, it's just to see a trend. Like, they'll never go. It never goes. You just got to see a downward trend and stuff. It's kind of too complicated for me to understand fully, but I do know what I'm looking at now because it's obviously consumed me for so long. But just keeping on top of it. And listen, I might not be right. And if I'm not, then yeah, it is, unfortunately. Like I can never be the same again, you know. But I just have to try and see what I can do, you know. Like, that's what I mean. Like, I know if I put the work in, I'm the best. No matter what people think, if you've been ill or not. Like, if I'm healthy and I put the work in, I'm better than anybody else. Like, I don't see how you
still think that.
I don't see how you can dispute it. I don't see how you can dispute it. Tell me when I've ever put the work in and not been ill and not been better than everybody else. Tell me, Daniel. Go on.
Well, as a counterpoint to that, you've always said, I remember back when you were 23, 24, you've always predicted that you would lose speed, maybe earlier than some sprinters because of the way you sprint and because you relied a lot on leg speed. So, you know, that might be one factor that people are considering when they imagine that you could have lost, that you could have fallen off a cliff.
I did all that in 2016 and then got ill in 2017. Do you just lose it like that overnight? I don't think you just lose it overnight, do you? Do you? I don't know.
We'll see.
You're a trainer. tell me, go and ask someone, I don't know. I don't think you just lose it from one day to the next, you just lose it. Doesn't happen. I'm sorry. I haven't studied physiology at uni. You cannot just lose it from one day to the next. It's not possible.
So in terms of sensations now on the bike, how good or bad or indifferent are they? How close are they to what you would like them to be?
It's the hard thing is to kind of measure it when you're training. You can't go as deep in training as you do in racing. You just, you can't do it. Like, well, I can't anyway, you know. Like, this new generation kind of can, you know, but racers, like real pure racers, can never go as deep in training as doing racing, you know, so you don't get the same feeling. And obviously you can, if you're tired in training, you can take an easier day, which you can't really do in racing. So it's hard to tell until I properly race, I guess, but yeah, like, I feel strong and the power's good. I'm just, I guess, like kind of a kind of threshold effort, like being able to sustain kind of an adequate amount of power on, say, an hour long climb. That's not as good as it was after doing, you know, 2 grand tours every year and not having time off the bike, I guess, you know. But of course, it's not bad, just not as good as it was. I don't think I'm going to be winning mountain stages at the tour, really. So,
is it possible, and I was speaking to Caleb Ewan a few weeks ago at the Lotto training camp, that he hasn't done a grand tour for a couple of years, and he says, well, in some ways it can benefit a sprinter in the sense for their speed it can maybe be beneficial, but obviously you lose endurance. I mean, do you think that's conceivable?
It's different for me anyway. It's always different, like, because I don't know, like, I just have zero slow twitch muscles, do I? So I always needed it to kind of help them, like, you know, so.
Because it's a game of freshness, not really of speed, ultimately, you know. It's the freshest sprinter that often wins.
Exactly. And I always thought, well, if I can, you know, get to the sprint in the best condition, that's when I win, you know, rather than just thinking of my sprint and not thinking about getting there.
Mark, I know you've got to go off to the gym in a minute, but I just wanted to ask you about your choice to come to Mallorca, because it's a place that I think you've got mixed feelings about due to the time you spent here when you were younger. I asked you whether you were going to do Sacca Lobbre yesterday, and you said that you have nightmares about that place, a very famous climb, of course. A lot of people will know it. Why exactly does it provoke such terror in you?
Right, like, yeah, I haven't been to Mallorca since I was at Sky, actually. So I reckon I spent a year of my life in this, on the island, you know, like 4 weeks a year for 10 years, you know. And I don't know, it just brought back horrible thoughts. Like at times, like, I'd always come, obviously in the winter I'd be more unfit than other guys, and all you do is train on the climb, so I was always slower than the other guys, you know. Which, you know, when you're younger and you get your head kicked in, it kind of doesn't leave a good lasting impression. But yeah, stuff like, I don't know, yeah, and stuff like we talked about in the first book, like when Simon Jones would say, "I teach you for eating chocolate bars at Christmas." You know what I mean? When you're a kid, like times in hotel rooms crying and that. Like, I just don't have nice memories.
Maybe you need to slay the dragon. Maybe you need to go back to Sacca Lobbre in particular to exercise that ghost.
But mate, honestly, in all the time I spent here, like being in Arenal and Plens and Alcudia and down at Robinson Club in the south, like being all around the island, staying with their various teams, now, I'd never, ever, ever in all that time been in the centre of Palma. Like, it's beautiful, isn't it? It's real nice. So actually, like, I was like, whoa. I quite like it here, you know, and actually I've put it to bed. I don't know if I'm going to go and do Sacca Lobbre. Just even the point, just why go down a hill knowing you've got to come back up it? I don't like doing rides that aren't loops. Don't like retracing my steps, you know. That's a little, I don't know, compulsive thing that I don't really like doing. I like having a loop, you know, and Sacca Lobbre don't really fit in that, does it? Unless we can take a boat round and start a ride from there. Do you know anyone with a boat?
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. You can still get 25% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. Now, we've got a question this week from Michael in Sydney, Australia, for the Science and Sport experts. Michael says, long-time fan. I listen to your podcast when I go out for my rides. That's nice to hear. I have a question for the Science and Sport guys I would really appreciate getting an answer to. In March this year, I'm doing the Three Peaks Challenge, Falls Creek. I haven't heard of this one, but it's in the Victoria, Australia region, and it's 235 kilometers with 4,000 meters of climbing. I'm around 90 kilograms, and I have a question regarding nutrition both before and on the ride. What sort of things should I have prior to the ride and whilst on it? I'm worried about having enough carbs through gels, bars, and normal food, plus preventing cramps. If I get some help with this, that would be great. Keep up the good work. And I plan on becoming a friend of the podcast this week. Well, Michael, we'll just check on that, but hopefully you do. In the meantime, here's your question answered by Ben Samuels at Science and Sport.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for the question. Looks like it's going to be a pretty big day in the saddle for you. The key with these challenges is to really follow best practice fueling guidelines, both pre-ride and in-ride. Your pre-ride meal should be in the range of 2 to 3 grams of carbohydrate per kilogram body mass. So for yourself, you'd be looking upwards of 180 grams of carbs. Now that should come from relatively simple sources, so as to minimise fibre intake and maximise muscle and liver glycogen storing. Options such as bread, cereal, pancakes, jams, fruit juices all work really well. You could then also utilise sports drinks, so you don't have to physically eat as much solid food. Try to include a protein serving alongside that meal too. Could come from food sources, yogurts, eggs, or even supplements. On the bike is then going to be aiming for 60 to 90 grams of carbohydrate per hour from a mix of food, gels, bars, and drinks. The key is going to be to be proactive with this, planning out each hour beforehand, and then on the day, make sure you're eating or drinking every 15 to 20 minutes. There's really then no one answer to beating the cramps. It's going to be a combination of training and preparing properly on the bike before the challenge, meeting energy and hydration during the ride, and then being in control of your pacing strategy.
Thank you, Ben, and thank you, Michael, from Sydney. Good luck on your ride. If you've got a question for the Science and Sport experts, you can email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. You can also leave a voice memo at the number +44 7971 338 205. And we are getting a few voice memos now, so we'll maybe play another one next week. But we heard before the break from Mark Cavendish, and he said a few very interesting things. I mean, sounded very defiant. Daniel.
Just as a point of order, Rich, he finished that interview by asking whether there was a boat one could catch to Sacalobra.
I know, yeah, we heard that.
And as a point of order, there is a boat, and I would recommend it to anyone who cycles in Mallorca, because from Soia or Port de Soia, where the boat leaves from, to go to Sacalobra on your bike takes about 2 hours. On the boat, it takes about 20 minutes, and it's a very nice ride.
I have a lot of sympathy with his position, with his view on that. I liked his explanation. He doesn't like to retrace his steps. He's always going forward.
I'm the same, but not everyone is. For example, when we'd stop recording, Mark told me that his Dimension Data teammate, Steve Cummings, is quite eccentric in a different way. In any given week, he'll do the same ride on a Monday, the same ride on a Tuesday, the same ride on a Wednesday. So he has a sort of 7-day rotation on his training rides. I'm sure he doesn't stick to it absolutely religiously, but he pretty much has the same sequence of rides that he does every week. I know a cycling journalist, I'm not going to say who it is because he sometimes contributes to another cycling podcast, who once told me that he does the same bike ride every single time he rides his bike.
Oh my word.
Extraordinary.
How odd.
Yeah.
That takes some willpower, surely. I'm completely in agreement. I mean, even a loop, I find kind of, when you know the destination is basically back at your house, it's like, that's why I really enjoyed the Cambridge Southwold Cambridge Classic that I did
place
for the Explore series. Yeah,
you've fantastic.
Place to place. It's
great fun.
If only we could all just ride somewhere, have two houses.
Anyway, that's
can I say one more thing about Sakalobra? It's a very unusual one, of course, because well, most people will know it's probably the iconic climb in Mallorca. It rises to about 680 meters, I think, above sea level, through a fantastic, almost Jurassic landscape, right up from a small bay called Sakalobra. And it's kind of a sort of upside down dead end. We're very used in cycling to, well, we often go to summit finishes in the major tours, but the dead end at Sakalobra is at the other end. It's at the sea end, and at the top you can actually carry on your ride and go left or right, and yeah, whatever you want.
Yeah, but this, let's talk about
I mean before we started recording, I said, you know, quite a few really strong news lines in what Cavendish said, and if you were writing up that interview, there'd be several headlines. His comments about Sakalobra was not what I was thinking about, to be honest.
No, I mean, this was Cavendish in sort of pugnacious form, wasn't it? On and off the bike, he's like a box of fireworks that needs to be stored out of you know, arm's length from any naked flame.
He needs an enemy, doesn't he? And Daniel, the way you framed a lot of the questions were, you know, people will say, and you set him up brilliantly. I don't know if that was deliberate, but there's nothing, it's like, you know, lighting a firework, telling him that people might say this.
Not me, Mark, but some people
some people are saying that you look slightly overweight this year.
I think the cheesecake was mine, not his, I should point out. I think his fans will take heart from the fact that pugnacious streak is very much intact. You know, I always felt that Mark Cavendish would start to fade at the moment in his career when that belligerent streak to his character also started to fade, and that's very much still there. He, you know, you can quibble about his, and the point he made about not losing his ability overnight. I mean, it is 3 years ago now, almost 3 years ago, that he had that fantastic year, 2016. Since then, he's obviously had a couple of seasons which have really been wiped out by Epstein-Barr virus. But he's still only 33, and I just looked up some stats, chaps, from the best sprinters of the last sort of 15-20 years, and a good number of them were very successful after the age of 33. I mean, Alessandro Petacchi won 8 out of his 48 Grand Tour stage wins after he turned 33. Robbie McEwen, it was 11 out of his 24. Mario Cipollini, it was 16 out of his 57. There were others who didn't fare quite so well. Oscar Freire won none of his 11 Grand Tour stage wins after the age of 33. Eric Szabo only 5 out of his 20. So, you know, there are no real hard and fast rules on, whether it's a sprinter or any other kind of rider, on when the decline starts to happen and how it happens, how precipitous that decline is. I mean, you hear all sorts of theories about, you know, people burning themselves out, maybe even in some cases before they turn professional, and that's going to mean that their career will be fairly short. But that doesn't really hold true. I mean, you look at a guy like Alejandro Valverde, who you can well imagine, and I think it's well documented, that throughout his time as a cyclist, even prior to his professional career, he was someone who was probably riding his bike 365 days a year. But he is now well into his late 30s and shows no signs of weakening. So it's just very, very difficult to predict. And I think even among physiologists, it's not very well understood, this mechanism of someone beginning their sort of slow fade into oblivion.
I think the thing is, Daniel, I mean, it's a year and a few days since Cavendish last crossed the line first in a race. That was in the Dubai Tour on the 8th of February last year. He beat Nasser Bouhanni and Marcel Kittel. And we kind of thought, oh, maybe this is him coming back from what had been a pretty disappointing second half to the previous season. But he's really struggled with this virus, which lingers on. It was interesting hearing him clarify that he wasn't ill twice. It's basically something that had not gone away, and that is the nature of Epstein-Barr or mononucleosis or glandular fever, however you wish to name it. I think the thing about, you know, to go back on the firework analogy, the whole point of fireworks is that, you know, you light the fuse and you watch the explosion. When they're in a box, they're pretty much pointless, and that's the difficulty. And hearing Cavendish saying that, you know, he doesn't have, you know, he's not built for that kind of endurance. Everything about his career is the explosion of the sprint finishes. And unfortunately, in cycling, there's a lot that needs to be done to get to the finish lines in the position to be able to light the fuse and enjoy the pyrotechnics. And we haven't seen those pyrotechnics from Cavendish for quite a long time. So it's not really that anyone's saying that he's lost it overnight. I don't think anyone has said that. It's this kind of, you know, he's kind of been lying dormant as a result of this illness for quite a long time now. And so I don't think it's unfair to say, well, it doesn't mean his innate ability has just been switched off like a light, but he is labouring under an illness which is hampering performance.
I think you're absolutely right, Lionel. And I think there are a few, you can have a few legitimate doubts, none of which are necessarily Mark Cavendish's fault. I mean, we also talked yesterday about how cycling's changed, and he kind of hinted at it in that interview that a road stage now is much more like a long time trial ridden in a peloton. The average speed tends to be more constant. It's a higher average speed, and it is more of a test of endurance than it used to be, when in the last 50 kilometers or 40 kilometers someone would flick a switch and then the sort of sprinters would start posturing, and you know, in a way it used to be more tactical, whereas you know, Mark sort of identified the entrance, the advent of Team Sky as the moment when it started to change, when it became a lot more about overall endurance over the 4 or 5 or 6 hours. And, you know, that trend has possibly accelerated or continued over the last 3 years since he's not been in the mix. There's another generation of sprinters that started to emerge, and their career curve is very much on the up, while his and riders of his generation, it has to be on the way down, you would think. So, you know, those things are certainly, well, they have to be overcome. On the other hand, he could no longer be said to be sort of just biding his time and tapping his fingers on a big contract before he rides off into the sunset. He's re-signed with Dimension Data last year. He's not on a big contract. I think he's got fairly sizable bonuses that he will obtain, will win if he does well in races like the Tour de France. And also, you know, that there are, I think, definitely signs that the hunger is still there. I mean, the fact that he's dedicated a lot of time this week to track work, and that's been a common theme whenever he's been successful, I think. I always feel that you should write him off at your peril, and I still kind of believe that, and particularly, as I said, with him only being 33 and a lot of sprinters having thrived at that age.
I would just say a point about his team as well. You know, his you know, that team, Dimension Data, has more or less been sort of built around him. And the recruitment this winter, interesting to try and, I guess, hedge bets and just make sure that they're not left empty-handed if Cavendish doesn't return to a Grand Tour stage-winning level. Roman Kreuziger's come in, gives them a little bit more in the stage races, and certainly maybe a mentoring role for Louis Menkes. But the two most interesting signings, I think, are Michael Valgren. I mean, I thought that was a peculiar one. I mean,
why?
I think he's better than Dimension Data. I mean,
well,
he won.
But presumably he'll get a lot of opportunities.
I guess so.
He's a very talented and still quite young rider. You could be right, but they need somebody like him who
could deliver some. He could deliver some big. I don't mean for the team. I think for the team, it's a great coup. I mean, a real good signing for them. But for Valgren himself, I don't know. I mean.
I think they've, you know, getting a bit of momentum is so important. I remember bumping into Doug Ryder at the Giro last year and him saying that he wished he'd invested in a hospital given the number of injuries and incidents they'd had last year. You know, Edvald Boasenhagen's win down in Valencia, really important, I think, for the team. And let's not forget, with Cavendish, there's the illness, but there were also the crashes last year. I mean, three really serious crashes, which, regardless of the virus, would have had a serious impact on him. And as you said, Lionel, he'd started the season quite well. You know, he'd won a race, which is not easy to do. So I think the crashes were a factor as well last year.
And absolutely. And I mean, just on the other rider that really is an interesting one, Enrico Gasparotto has signed as well. And between Valgren and Gasparotto, that gives them coverage across most of the classics. And again, it's about that morale boosting level of performance, isn't it? If you're invisible for the first 3 months of the season, everybody's on a downer. Let's not forget that last year, Dimension Data's first World Tour win of the season didn't come until the Vuelta, did it? Ben King. And then once he won one, he won another one, very impressive by Ben King, but really salvaged the season for them. This year, they've got, you can look at Kreuziger at 32, Gasparotto at 36, and think, well, these are kind of old but steady signings that are reliable. And I think that's one of the things.
Ben O'Connor, quite an exciting young prospect as well for the stage races.
So the pressure isn't on Cavendish, is it, Daniel? I mean, that's the thing. The pressure will be all internal.
No, I agree. And I think the beauty of a rider like Valgren, we've talked in the past few months about the need now with smaller teams to have these multi-purpose riders who can excel on various different types of terrain. And I think from Valgren's point of view, that the danger they're in, if he's at a bigger team, a team like his previous team, Astana, is that he's so good and so versatile that he will be repurposed almost on their whims. You know, if a team leader, if Miguel Angel Lopez needs someone to do a job in the mountains, then Valgren's a guy who can do that. If one of their classics riders needs a hand in the cobbled classics, they can send him there. Whereas at Dimension Data, there will be races, I'm sure, where he will be the undisputed top dog. And there are various other changes at Dimension Data. They've changed they've had a complete overhaul of the medical staff over the winter. They've got a new bike. Cavendish is very happy with his new bike. I understand that's the case of some of the other riders in the team as well. So, there's a fair bit that's changed. And Cavendish has certainly said over the winter that he feels like it's almost like a new team.
I take it back about Valgren. It makes perfect sense. You're right. He's gone from a kind of a position where he might be called upon to do lots of different things to one where he could be the bona fide leader for some big races. So, stand corrected on that.
Yeah, I remember a stage, the Tour de France last year, with Magnus Cort won into, where was that? I can't remember now. Carcassonne. And, you know, Valgren was pretty much used up there to set it up for Magnus Cort. And I think he won Het Nieuwsblad last year, and he's just a very talented rider on quite a range of different races, from Het Nieuwsblad, the Cobble Classics, to the Ardennes. So, yeah, looking forward to seeing what he does. We should wrap things up, chaps. We're getting on a bit again.
Only a couple of weeks until Omloop Het Nieuwsblad. The first proper race of the season. Yep. And I'll be there.
You'll be there, Lionel. And should we mention Friends specials again? We've got, Lotto Jumbo. Jumbo Visma, the special out. Dylan Groenewegen, their sprinter. Mm. Very impressive in Valencia with a stage win there. And that's out for Friends of the Podcast. Sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com/friends.
It's £15. You can also listen to our Grand Tour Diaries already from last year. Effectively an audiobook for a couple of quid, really, if you think about it.
That's amazing. A no-brainer.
Did Groenewegen look impressive in Valencia, chaps, do you think?
Well, I mean, the way he won that stage was impressive, the speed at the end.
Someone I know, I also thought he looked okay. Someone I know said they thought he looked as though he'd been on the cheesecake. But
someone you know. Was this somebody?
No, it was actually not him. It was not someone who I met recently.
So you were having a conversation over cheesecake, and then somebody
just randomly mentioned cheesecake.
No, different conversation, different set of circumstances.
You're gonna have to do better than that to cover your tracks, Daniel. Anyway, let's leave it for this week. We'll be back next week. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
You have been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.